Romans 15, verse 1, page 46. We are getting down toward the end of it here. Now we who are strong ought to bear the weaknesses of those without strength and not just please ourselves. Let each of us please his neighbor for his good and to his edification. For even Christ did not please himself, but as it is written, the reproaches of those who reproach thee fell upon me. For whatever was written in earlier times was written for our instruction, that through perseverance and the encouragement of the Scripture we might have hope. Now may the God who gives perseverance and encouragement grant you to be of the same mind with one another, according to Christ Jesus, that you may, with one accord, you may with one voice glorify God, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. We need to consider ourselves, others, as more important than ourselves. It is, remember, the second great commandment is to love your neighbor as yourself. And the heart of all of us is to be self-oriented. And Paul tells us that we need to consider others as more important than ourselves. And there are so many ways that we do that, or can do that. One, of course, is to realize that other people need what we have and to share what we have with them. Some of it's just what we call good old Southern hospitality. You let somebody else through the door first. You help somebody here or there. You go out in the rain to get something for somebody because you care for them more than you care for yourself. All of us have learned growing up in the South that you do that you care for people. And all of us have reaped the reward of what it feels like to do something for someone else. Many of God's rewards are just are embedded inside of the actions that God teaches. So that when we do the things that are right, the reward is there, even if we don't know God. Earlier on, Paul said that when the heathen who does not know the law, when the Gentile who does not know the law, the unbeliever, does what the law requires, they become a witness that the law is in itself true, or they become a witness that the law is good. So if a person, for instance, is a generous man, we've seen people on TV who go out on the streets and they give people $100, or they do this or that, or they write a check for this or that, to whatever. We see people who have learned benevolence, that benevolence is good, philanthropy. We see Bill Gates, for instance, trying to give away a lot of money. And one of the reasons that we do that is because it makes us feel good about ourselves. There's an intrinsic benefit in it. We give it out, and we feel good about it. When we have saved the life of a small child, we feel good about that. You save the life of a puppy, you feel good about it. I mean, the point is, when we lay our life down for someone else, we feel good about it. It's embedded in the action. So that anyone who does what is God's will receive at least that much reward, no matter who they are. And so it says here that we need to consider others as more important than ourselves. Now, the context in which Paul's writing here is that he's been talking about eating food offered to idols, or in our more modern terminology, drinking alcohol as Christians. As I've mentioned to you before, all meat that was sold in butcher shops, or for that matter, killed on the farm, was offered to an idol, or to a god of some kind in the ancient world. As they would kill the animal, they'd say, "We dedicate this animal who's about to give his life, her life, to whomever." And that included the Jews. The Jews blessed God and dedicated the animal sacrifice to God. And they would take the hooves and the horns and the fat, and they would burn it to the Lord as a sacrifice. And the hides and the meat were then, therefore, available to Jews to have to use, unless it was an immolation sacrifice or a total burning of the animal, which happened from time to time and for various reasons. But as a rule, all animal sacrifices by the Levites were had as a result, an ultimate result, that the meat was then cut up and carved and wrapped and sold or given to people in accordance with whatever was going on. As I mentioned to many of you before, you can't be a Christian unless you've seen Fiddler on the Roof. And Fiddler on the Roof has in it a guy whose name is Laser Wolf. Laser Wolf is the butcher. He's a Levite. All Levites were butchers. If you... let's see if I got this. Yeah. If you have ever seen the tabernacle or the temple, then what you know is it was made up of a series of areas. the smallest area, now the tabernacle, the temple was formed after the tabernacle. But the smallest area, the center area, the little tent in the center was called the Holy of Holies. And that was the place where God dwelt. It's where the Ark of the Covenant was kept. It was the place where the lamp, eternal lamp, was burning before the Lord. And it was a place where no one could go except by God's permission. When they built the temple, the Holy of Holies was built on Mount Moriah, where Abraham sacrificed Isaac, right on that spot. And on the, in fact, inside of the temple's Holy of Holies is a large flat stone that was the stone on which he tried to sacrifice or attempted to sacrifice his son before the Lord stopped him. So the central, the smallest little piece, and the tabernacle was a series of tents, topless tents that moved out concentrically. And the smallest piece was the Holy of Holies. In order to go into the Holy of Holies, you had to offer for yourself sacrifice for your own sins. The high priest went in once a year to make atonement for the people. It was one of the official sacrifices. Other people went in to do things like clean and that sort of thing, but they had to make atonement for their sins before they went in. And were someone to go into to the Holy of Holies, whether it was the tabernacle or the temple, and failed to do that, they would drop over dead. It happened not infrequently. And so consequently, the people who went into the Holy of Holies were required to wear bells on the bottoms of their garments so that as they walked around inside, they could be heard to be located. And if they walked in and the bells were going along and all of a sudden there was this thump, 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 then they knew that somebody else had failed to make a proper sacrifice before the Lord. And so as a matter of course, they took these meat hooks, big meat hooks that were on ropes. They stuck their hand through the curtain and flung the meat hooks in the direction where they last heard the bells. And they grabbed them and snagged them and drug them out. That was the practice. And the reason it was done that way is because you just didn't go in there to get them. No one went in the Holy of Holies unless they had purified themselves by sacrifice, not just externally, but internally as well. And so that was the Holy of Holies. Outside of the Holy of Holies was a courtyard, and it was the courtyard of the priest. And the courtyard of the priest was where the sacrifices were done. Now, the courtyard of the priest was a slaughterhouse. Remember, in the tabernacle, it's built on ground. And even in the temple, it's built on ground because there is the killing of animals going on there morning from morning till dusk. They were slaughtering these animals in here. And the animals would be brought in, they would be prayed over, they would be killed kosher. In other words, they would be killed in such a way as to dump the blood out of them so the blood wouldn't get in the meat and the toxins in the blood wouldn't get in the meat. And it was a messy place. Not only was it bloody, but it was messy because these are animals. And there was other things going on, and you slit an animal's throat and things happen. So it was a very messy place. There was a huge, huge cauldron of water there that was used to constantly clean what was going on. And even in the temple itself, there was like little gutters to the side so that they could flush everything that way and get it out. It was, I don't know, I was raised on farms, and if you've ever been in a farm that raised pigs, any of you? Well, if you go out in the back of the pig house, where everything is dumped, nothing grows, you know. Nothing goes where nothing grows where Bambi goes. When they clean the bottom of the hog house out back, it is a wasteland back there because of just the high nitrogen stuff in there just destroys everything. And so it's a messy place. And the killing of animals is a messy place. We talk about the Levite priests, you know, and everybody has in mind somebody walking around in a robe and all looking pretty and whatever. It's not that way. These guys wore aprons and they came home covered from top to bottom. In Kentucky, where I'm from, if you were a hog farmer, and I knew some really good ones, you built your house on the hill downwind, upwind. And what you did was you would go down and you would work in your hog barns, and then you would build another place down here where you could go and change and clean up. And then after you got done with that, you would go up to the house and clean up again. And even still, you smelled like pigs all the days of your life. One of the guys, greatest evangelists I know, is a guy named Tommy Line, and he had a farm like that. We used to go visit him. He would go out in the streets of Bowling Green, Kentucky, and bring in all these kids who were on drugs and whatever, and bring them to his his hog farm and cause him to come to know the Lord. But that's the way it worked. And if you wanted to be a gentleman farmer and not smell to high heaven all the time, you had to learn how to wash early and often. You didn't take your working clothes to the house because it'd ruin your machines. It was that way. So it was a messy place. And that's what these Levites were. They were in this place and they were killing these animals. And so Levites are butchers. In the ancient pagan world, it was the same, because all animals were sacrificed to gods and goddesses. And if you went to a pagan butcher shop, there would be a note over the door, chiseled in stone, if it was an expensive place, and it would say, "This meat has been offered to Athena. This meat has been offered to Artemis. This meat has been offered to Diana the Huntress," which was also Athena. "This meat has been offered to Zeus." And there were people who would tell you, "You know, I really like the meat offered to Athena. It's better. It just has a better quality about it." You know, like people talk about wines, you know. The aroma of the bouquet. There was people who were snobbish about which god or goddess their meat was offered to and whether that was good. And so when you went to sit down at someone's house for dinner, they would say, "The steaks come from Athena." Okay? So here you are. You've got these Jewish people, and they're living among themselves. They have no fellowship with the Gentiles whatsoever. It's not a problem. But now you've got Christians. Christians, people who are Jews who become Christians, and then people who are Gentiles who become Christians, and they're starting to fellowship together. They're starting to come together as one group of people. And what happens is that the one group is raised very strictly about what you eat and don't eat, and the other group is raised in a way that doesn't consider that. And so what happens is you go to someone's house for dinner. Maybe they're a Christian, maybe they're just a business associate and they're not a Christian, and they go, "You'll love the steaks they're offered to Athena." What do you do? What do you do? Do you say, "Well, I'm a vegetarian"? Do you say, "I don't eat meat offered to your crummy god"? What do you say? And by the way, could we sign a big business deal? What do you say? And so it caused problems. Now, Jews didn't have problems because they didn't go into Gentiles' houses, but Christian Jews did. So now they're fellowshipping. What do you do? And so there was a controversy. The Gentile Christians would say, "Well, you know, I ought to be able, if I want to serve steaks from this butcher shop. I mean, it's not a big deal. It's not a big deal." And the Jewish people would say, "Well, you know, I'm sorry, but I can't do that." And there was an issue. Or the Gentile, you might go to a Gentile's house for dinner, a guy, and he would say, "You're going to love the ribs. You're going to love the ribs." And they would say, "Well, you know, I'm not supposed to eat ribs." And so there was this issue. And so Paul said to these people, "Look, if you feel like you have the freedom to eat this meat that's been offered to idols, or meat that Jews, other people don't eat, fine. If God's given you the liberty to do that, that's fine. If that's what you feel like between you and God, that's fine." Because Paul said it's true. Idols are nothing. And meat being offered to idols is not a problem. But it is a problem if they think it is. And so if you bring them in and you say, "Why don't you have one of these steaks offered to Athena?" And they go, "Well, okay." And then later on they go home and they go, "I have sinned. I shouldn't have done that." You have used your liberty to cause them to stumble. Because Paul says down here in Romans 14, "But he who doubts is condemned if he eats, because his eating is not from faith, and whatever is not from faith is sin." So if I think something's wrong, even if it's not, and I do it anyway, I have committed sin. If I am willing to offend God, even though I'm mistaken about what's an offense, I have sinned against the Lord because I'm willing to offend him. And so what he's saying is that, look, if you're having Jewish Christians over, you Gentile Christians, be considerate of the fact that they may not be able to eat certain things and provide for them. I do meeting planning for a living. It's one of the things that I do. And I have meals for 3,000 people. I have meals for 200 people, but I also have meals for 3,000 people. And one of the things that I have to always remember is that when I'm serving meals for large groups of people, I need to be sure there's plenty of edible vegetables for those people who don't eat meat. I need to be sure that there's fish on Friday for those people for whom that's an important thing. And if I want to be hospitable to my customers, that's what I do. I serve them things that they can eat. If, for instance, there are some things that, we warn people, there are pine nuts in this. The dessert, the cards, as they're going down, they'll say contains pine nuts. That's because we don't want one of our customers going apoplectic and being hauled out, you know, on a cart. We want to warn them. We want to be considerate of them. We want to consider other people as more important than ourselves. And that's just heathen business. We're doing that, okay? So what he's saying is that if you've invited someone to your home and they have a moral issue with this or that, then be considerate of them and don't put them in a position where they might stumble. Now, in our day and age, the practicality of this usually resolves around alcohol. And the reason is because there are some Christians who are raised up to believe that the drinking of alcohol is not for Christians. They believe that it's not right for a Christian to drink alcohol. And they've been raised that way since they were young. They find biblical support for it, they think. And so they're sure that you shouldn't drink alcohol. The fact that Jesus drank alcohol and the disciples drank alcohol and all that other stuff is not persuasive to them. They believe you should not drink alcohol. And so when you invite somebody over to your home and they are of that persuasion, don't serve alcohol. Because if you do and they wind up stumbling, and they go home and they feel like they've sinned because they drank the alcohol, maybe just to be kind to you or to be gracious to you. But they go home and they go, I shouldn't have done that. Paul says you're using your liberty as a mechanism to cause them to sin. You shouldn't do that. He says we should consider others as more important than ourselves. And if they've got issues with alcohol, don't put them in a position to stumble. If there are certain things that you know that they believe are wrong, don't flaunt them in front of them just because you think they're okay. We should not use our liberty as an excuse to cause our brother to stumble. Now, more importantly, let's suppose that they're an alcoholic. Let's suppose that the person you're inviting over is someone you know is a friend of Bill W.'s, somebody who's going to meetings, somebody who's wrestling with this. Should you then serve alcohol and say, well, you know, they can drink tea? And the biblical answer would be no. Don't put your brother or sister in a position where they might stumble just because you have liberty. That's what Paul is talking about here. We don't think much about meat offered to idols, but we do have to deal with this other issue. And there are other things like that. For instance, I happen to enjoy reading Harry Potter books. But I know that there are many, many Christians who don't like Harry Potter. They believe that Harry Potter's wrong and that their children should not be reading Harry Potter. And so if I have children over and I know their parents are not, don't want them reading Harry Potter, I don't say, you know, you love this book. You ought to read this book. You know, they're nuts. It's nothing really wrong with this book. It's really fun. That would be sinful for me. And, you know, if I persuaded somebody to read Harry Potter who thought maybe they shouldn't and they read it anyway, and then afterwards, their heart convicted them that they had been disobedient to their parents or to God because they felt that way, then I have caused them to sin, even though in my mind, and I believe that there's nothing wrong with Harry Potter. But because they're willing to sin, they have sinned. That's what Paul's saying here. We need to consider others as more important than ourselves. If anyone is weak, and it means weak in faith, if anyone lacks faith to eat meat offered to idols, or lacks faith to drink alcohol, or read Harry Potter, or other things, we need to be considerate of his weakness. Another example, I think, is let's say that you're really into some television show, Friday Night Lights, okay, CSI Miami. You're really into those shows, and you feel in your heart that they're not polluting you. They're fine. I mean, they're all whatever, but they're fine. And you invite somebody over and they get to talking about that and they say, well, you know, we don't watch the show. We just feel like it's too worldly. You know, what do? Say, oh, come on. You know, it's not, don't be silly. You know, don't be ridiculous. It's not that bad. The pastor watches it, you know. When we do something like that, we are inviting our brothers and sisters to stumble. And Paul says, don't do that. If you see that someone has a religious sensitivity for something, and even though you think it is okay, don't press the issue. Back off. Be considerate of your brother, your sister. That's what Paul's saying here. That's the type of issue he's talking about. I know that as we go along, God convicts us little by little about things that we see on TV. Nancy and I used to have a whole list of our favorite shows, and all of them are gone. Because little by little, God has convicted us that they don't do us any good. They pollute our spirits. And even though they're exciting and fun in lots of ways, they promulgate ideas and notions and belief systems that are contrary to what it is that we hold and espouse. And even if they're not like deathly sinful, there's better things we can do with our time. There's more profitable things that we can do with our time. The Scripture says all things are lawful, but not all things are profitable. And so God has sort of led us to quit doing certain, watching certain kinds of shows. And we're like everybody else. We go, you know, should we watch that? Eh, whatever. Let's watch it. You know, and after a while, it's kind of like, all right, look. You know, we've quit this show 3 times. This is it. Last time we're going to quit this show. We're done with the show. As we become more and more sensitive to the Lord's going to speak to us about things like that. You know, where do you go? That sort of thing. So, what do you do? And as we begin to develop our own sense of sensitivity and a realization that God's calling us to not do something, we would appreciate people being sensitive to us along those levels. If we go to somebody's house and they go, you just got to see this latest episode of CSI Miami, the girls, boy, the girls, you know, I mean, it's, you know, and we're going, yeah, we, whatever. Oh, no, you got to see it. We don't need to be doing that to each other. We need to be sensitive to each other's sense of what they feel is right and wrong and fellowship. We do not need to use our liberty as an excuse for someone to stumble. Weakness in anything that causes one to sin. Weakness is anything that causes one to sin. You know, so comments. Okay, if you feel like that reading Harry Potter is fine, Nancy and I grew up spiritually in the charismatic movement, and it was really big against anything spiritual that was negatively spiritual. And any mention of witches or any of those sorts of things was just total anathema for us. Our children didn't trick or treat, all that sort of thing. We were seriously committed to the idea that we avoided all those kinds of things. And over the years, God has sort of spoken to us about various aspects. For instance, you start reading C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia. Well, Chronicles of Narnia is something that most evangelicals think is just wonderful for you to read to your kids. But what's it got in it? It's got, you know, talking lions and witches and satyrs and all kinds of things that sort of fit in the bad category. And so then you read, you know, Tolkien's trilogy. And you've got the same kinds of things going on. You've got dwarves and elves and all these spiritual beings that are, some are good and some are bad. And so what happens is it challenges you and you begin to think through the issue. And Harry Potter comes out, and the people who are really against all this, they rise up and they stand, oh, you know, it's going to lead our kids to hell and they're all going to be practicing curses and stuff like that. And so maybe your initial response is, well, gee, you shouldn't do that. We stayed away from it. And then we got to a scenario where I felt like I just wanted to see for myself. And as I read the book and watched the movie or whatever, I decided that it was not problematic for me at my level. Now, there are things are. I will not watch horror films. I won't watch demonic manifestations on television shows. I think those things are spiritually evil. That's how they hit me. But as I dealt with Harry Potter, I didn't feel that way. I felt like that it was a struggle between good and evil, with good being espoused. And so I felt like it was a metaphor that was acceptable. My grandkids, my daughter, my very close daughter, whom I'm very spiritually connected, does not agree that way. Okay, and so consequently, we wouldn't even think of encouraging them that was okay. You know, your mother doesn't want you. You know, we won't do that. So if someone comes, if you feel like you've done the analysis on this spiritually, and you feel like it's okay for your kids to read Harry Potter, and you tell them so, and then somebody comes along and says, "Oh, you shouldn't read that. It's evil." Then what you should tell your children is that's what their opinion is. That's what their opinion is. But you don't hold that opinion. And so it's permissible for them, as far as you, the parent, are concerned, you know, for them to read these. By the same token, you're probably going to tell them that they shouldn't watch the Saw series, you know, on the horror films, or they shouldn't watch, you know, the Halloween 13 and all that kind of stuff because of what it does. You may take that position. So you're saying this is okay, but that's not. And because they're your children, you get to decide. Somebody else doesn't get to decide. Other comments? Yeah, and the thing about J.K. Rowling is he has become a Christian since she started writing these. So, you know, and I think if you look up them as metaphors for good and evil, like Star Wars, for instance. I remember when Star Wars first came out, that we had churches that would rise up and preach against Star Wars. Because, you know, you shouldn't do that. And, I mean, some parents took that very, very seriously. And I actually prayed about it. You know, should we or shouldn't we? I went to see the thing, just to decide for myself. And I decided that it was a nice allegory for good versus evil. I felt like it gave evil more credit than it should, but nonetheless, I felt like that it was a good allegory, and I had no problem with that. There are, pardon?
May the force be with us.
Yeah. There were lots of other, in fact, I saw tracts that came out where some churches took the whole notion of Star Wars and created positive Christian tracts out of them. You know, the bright side of the forces. Yeah, I mean, they, you know, people use the metaphors in totally opposite ways. And so, the important thing to remember though is that whatever does not proceed from faith is sin. If I think something's wrong, and I do it anyway, it's sin for me. If I think it might be wrong, but I do it anyway, I'm demonstrating a willingness to offend God. It's sin for me. And so I can't just go out and do something and say, well, you know, it's probably not right, but I'm going to do it anyway. Even if it's intrinsically right or okay, it's sin for me because I've been willing to offend God. Other comments? I have utmost respect for the personal opinions of any person who feels like that this or that is right or wrong. It's not my job to explain to anybody what's right or wrong. It's the job of the Holy Spirit. One of the things that we have as human beings that's detrimental to us and to our relationships is this innate desire to control other people. The idea that somehow or another we know what's best and we should make them understand that. That it's my job to go and make them understand something. Tell them what it is that they should do. That I'm doing them a favor. I'm trying to save them by coercing them to believe the truth. Even if I have to make their life a little miserable, it's all for their good. And that's witchcraft, the scripture says. That's witchcraft. It is not our job to convict anybody of sin. Our job is to live in such a way as to be a witness to Christ and to be available to share that witness with them when they ask. One of the problems that a lot of people have with their friends is their behaviors are so abusive and so oppressive and so intervention-oriented that when that person decides they need some help, the last person they'd come to see is that person. We burn our bridges to our friends because we take stuff over those bridges they weren't meant to handle. You can't take a tank over a bridge that's meant for a footbridge. It'll be destroyed. One moment. And so consequently, we need to realize, and this is true with our children, we need to realize that the more our children are aware, the more responsibility they have for making their own decisions and their own mistakes. And I know it's painful to sit and watch your children make mistakes. We have a right and an obligation to teach them, but we don't have a right and obligation to control them. When's the last time God ever stopped you from doing anything you wanted to do? And the answer is never. So we need to take our cue from God and not from someone else. Now, what that also means, Will, is that whatever we suffer because of our own choices. And unfortunately, we do learn some things the hard way. I did. I learned some things the hard way. My parents got smarter as I got older. I got smarter to my kids as I got older. So hopefully what we'll do is volunteer to learn where we can. However, we are wrong to try to control behaviors and the beliefs of other people. Yeah, you had a question, brother?
I was just going to say, back one step. One of the things I've struggled with is with teaching kids, my own kids, the concept that it's okay if it's their opinion, and you know that's not an opinion that you share, that's okay, is to teach that without ingraining some sort of sense of relativism. You know, there are some truths,
mm-hmm.
and whether somebody else is just different opinion,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's a struggle with that issue, it seems to me, with teaching the kids and any additional thought.
Well, what happens is we say, look, this is right and this is wrong. You may have an opinion in variance to that, but you will suffer the consequences for that. But I'm not going to make you, I'm not going to go rush in here and I used to tell Nancy, we need our children to fail early and often. Because, and we do this all backwards. There used to be a phrase for that. We do this all backwards. What happens is that when they're little, we go through this whole process of protecting them from the consequences. Because they're little, right? And then what happens is they get up and they get bigger than we can do that with, or maybe they go off to college, and for the first time in their life, they're actually facing real choices by themselves. And the consequences at that level are enormous. We grew up in a church where people were very controlling over their children, what they believed, how they acted. And then, these kids were heavy into their youth groups and the whole nine yards, and they all said the right thing. They went off to college, they got pregnant, got on drugs, they flunked out of school, they did all these kinds of things, because the first time in their life they ever had to make a choice or decision from the self was when they got away from home. And the consequences of that level were far more expensive. And so what we really want to do is to let our young children, I mean, you got to keep them on the street, you know, and you tell them, don't touch the burner. It'll burn your hand. But sooner than later, we got to go, let me know, I'll get the butter out, you know.
I'm sorry, I wasn't actually meaning that so much, because I tell, when I talk to people over at this guy, I tell them that one of the reasons I love him is it's a safe place for my kids to fail, and they sort of look at it. But I was talking more about kids' interactions with us. You know, how do you teach them that it's okay to be accepting of the fact that their belief system is very different, and yet there are things that are either right or wrong. They can develop their own sense of, well, if I think this is okay, it's okay. And you don't want that either.
I think what you do is you tell kids that it's okay for people to be wrong. The point is that they are wrong, but it's okay for them to be wrong. They will learn. Now, if someone comes and asks you, what should I do, then you have permission. Drive a tank through that hole. You know, but if when they stop, say, okay, you no longer have permission, then you stop. But what you really want to do is to create a relationship that's so good that people will come and seek you for your advice, and particularly your kids. Parents burn bridges with their kids trying to control them. When we were going through the stuff we went through with our son, our house was the hangout place. And the kids would come to our house and they would tell us all the stuff they were doing and all the things they were into and whatever. And we'd say, and they would tell us all the stuff, ways they were hurting. And they would say, you know, this or this and there's that and I'm miserable and I got this going on and whatever. And we would say, well, have you shared this with your parents? And they'd say, I couldn't begin to tell my parents this. You know, they would kill me. I mean, they wouldn't stop crying. I couldn't even begin to tell them. Well, that's a shame. That's a shame. When I did Ben's funeral, I did the sermon at Ben's funeral. And when I did, I got up and I shared Ben's story. And it was the first, there were 750 people at that funeral. It was on a Monday when school was out. There were 750 people there and 250 of them were kids, which means 500 of them were adults. Now, I don't have 500 friends. I'm down here. These were parents of these kids and other people that knew Ben, that because, you know, Ben was a very nice, polite boy. He was a drug addict, but he was a very nice, polite boy. And parents liked him. It was the first time that many of those parents knew that Ben had a problem with drugs, was when I shared it from the pulpit. Now, Ben had been clean and sober for 14, 15, 16 months before he died. But he had, for 3 years, been a drug addict. And it was the first time that they knew that. Because we think we know who the drug addicts are. We don't. We think we know who the drug users are. We don't. You know, they're our kids. And so when they heard Ben's story, they came to me and said, I had no idea that he was into all that. And at the same time, they were sitting around going, and he was my daughter's best friend. There was a whole bunch that happened around that. It was people who had been hiding their head in the sand. I began to realize what it was. So I think what you do is you say, honey, this is truth. It's like gravity, you know. This book is going to fall. It's not going to hang in the air. It doesn't matter what you do, it's going to fall. That's truth. Now, having said that, you're going to test that from time to time. And when you do, and it falls, I want you to know I'm here for you. I'm here to help you out. But I encourage you to learn early and often so that you don't learn hard later. The kinds of consequences that it takes when you have to go and do stuff with the principal, or you got to take them into the store and they got to give back the money and all that kind of stuff, or you know, those kind of consequences are nothing compared to watching them being handcuffed and hauled off, watching them going into the rehab center by court order. I mean, having them come home pregnant and not knowing what to do, or seeing them dead on a slab because they got drunk and drove a car. So I would just tell them, we need to always stand against relativism. Relativism is wrong, but when we stand against anything, we need to stand against it, not the people. We don't want to stand against the people. We want to stand against the idea or the concept. Homosexuality is wrong, but I love you. Homosexuality is wrong. I love you. Okay. Premarital sex is wrong, but I love you. Using drugs is wrong, but I love you. And it's not just wrong, it's also harmful. It'll hurt you. And one thing I learned about kids early on often, now this is a little secret, if you don't know this, you'll appreciate this. I know. all right, I'll shut. But it says, that, remember this, kids do not respond well to right and wrong, but they respond absolutely 100% to fair and unfair. If you want your children to pay attention to what you have to say, couch it in terms of fair and unfair. Is it fair, you know, for us to have to lose our vacation because you've chosen to do this? Is it fair that we have to do that? Is it fair that we have to pay thousands of dollars? Is it fair? Is it fair? Kids will absolutely respond to fair or unfair. They have this innate sense that you need to be fair. And so if you can learn to couch what you have to say in terms of fair and unfair as opposed to right and wrong, you may find them thinking it through a little deeper than they would otherwise. All right, we will start in verse 7 next time. Other comments before we close this down?
I was just thinking, you know, when our son was young, and we, part of our family is from the Mennonites, and so that's a different faith group, and I tried to explain this to him when he was younger, you know, about the diversity. I don't think he really got it, but I wished I had used this text right here, because I think, and I think you titled it exactly right, diversity requires love and grace for one another, because God's grace is sufficient for the diversity in this. And that's, in mind, that's how I see
it. Yeah. Yeah, when Ben got into trouble, I went and looked in the Bible, and I came to the prodigal son. What I noticed was the behavior of the prodigal son's father. He let the kid take the fortune and blow it in hopes that when he got into deep trouble, he would come to his senses and come home. And then he went and looked down the road every day for him to return. And that's how God treats us. God lets us make our mistakes. I mean, we sit around and we say to our children, don't do this, 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 don't do this. Don't do this. And when we were their age, we were going, gotcha. We need to trust God. It's a faith. You know, raising kids, I always tell people having a child is a 20-year sentence followed by a lifetime of parole. raising kids is a faith exercise. All relationship is a faith exercise because all relationships are based in trust. Yeah, trust. All right, who's going to pray us out?